This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 90-year-old ex-prisoner of war, Frank Kravitz of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I was only in Pittsburgh for less than 24 hours, and Frank was actually in the hospital recovering from an injury. But his wife, Anne, thought he should do the interview anyway. I'm so glad we did. And Anne told me a story that might turn your stomach a little bit. Is certainly unique, though, and worth talking about. Your wife told me about a really unorthodox way the doctors decided to fight infection in your wounds to help save your leg. What was that all about?
Well, when I was first taken to the hospital, they put the maggots on my... What was the question again?
So your wound was infected, and they used maggots.
Right. That's the first thing they did. After maggots were in there, I'm under sheet tent, like, you know, so it wouldn't be touching the operation. Then all of a sudden, I could lay on my back with a pillow maybe that big, and, you know, I'm looking up, and every other day or so, that the British orderlies or doctors were looking at, and then when they finally come, rinse it off because it turned white, now they start cleaning the wound. And then they started the operation of taking skin from my rear end, and we put them in some kind of fluid and that, and put it on my wound, and it coagulated on my wound. And that's the skin grafting I had.
This is really serious stuff that you had to deal with. And I guess there's another instance. We talked about your crewmate saving your life and the German saved your life. I guess the maggot saved at least your leg?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, there's a funny thing about that, too. When I come home, I started to... maybe up at the VFW or wherever I was, I joined the VFW right away, yeah. And everybody's talking, listening. And one of my other friends was a POW, you know, and they hear us talking about having these maggots taking care of our wounds, you know. And he says, oh, you guys are full of crap. They don't use maggots, you know, and actually made a joke out of it and everything else. I resented the fact, you know. You know, I resented it. I said, okay, I'll shut my mouth. You're going to be that way. Nobody's going to believe me anyway, so, right? You know, so I shut my mouth. I didn't tell my parents. I didn't tell anybody about how they took care of it, you know. Many years later, and I can't say it was 10, 15, or 20 like that, there was an article in the Pittsburgh Press, a big spreadsheet, not talking about military. A doctor up in one of the towns north of me is using maggots for certain wounds in that, you know. Mm-hmm. I cut that sucker out so fast, put it in my pocket, you know, and anybody ever mentioned it again, I tell you, here. You know, I tell you, my pro-wife probably didn't believe it. So, so it's so far-fetched. Yeah. Nobody knows about that, you know.
Well, and it's not one you want to tell at a dinner party, I suppose. Might turn a few stomachs.
No, but... those are just the tidbits that are true. That's all I know how to tell you. That's true.
Well, and obviously the fact that we're sitting here talking and the fact that that you have three children and five grandchildren, none of them would have been here if you didn't make it through all this, if you didn't survive, if you weren't eventually liberated. And sounds like there's a pretty good story about the day of your liberation and some things that you saw that you'll never forget. This was in Moosburg, Germany.
Well, I arrived at this camp from our long march from Nuremberg to Moosburg, Germany.
How long was the march?
90 kilometers. It took us about 15 or 16 days to walk, you know.
With anything to eat or no?
Yeah, we had whatever we could scrounge, you know. People, there were Germans that had potatoes, and somebody had something, could do a barter with them. Well, and whatever we saved to go on the trip that we had in the sack to sustain us, you know.
You're in Nuremberg. And you marched 16 days to Moosburg.
And when we got inside of Moosburg, it was already crowded from other camps being vacated and the things, men coming in, prisoners coming into the same compound. So it ended up, historically, it says that they were over 100,000 all nationality prisoners of war, Germans, French, whatever, at this camp. And on April 29th, our senior officer in charge, United States Army, that were opposing the Germans that were protecting their prisoners. They were about to release them. They sent a group to the German groups there, the white flags and that. They come back, and the Germans refused. They're going to attack the camp. So, and we didn't know this, but that's the historically what it was, you know. So it was about 9 o'clock in the morning on April 29th that the fire started. Our tanks start coming down over the hill. We saw them, and then all kind of vehicles, you know, and so much fire, you know, was going. And I guess the confrontation lasted maybe about an hour and a half. And our people inside says, lay on the ground, get under the barracks, get it done, because the fire's going on. And just hoping they're shooting at our troops, and we're getting the residuals of it, you know, from in the air, you know. Some fellas were hurt, you know, from it, you know. Shortly before noon, we saw the flag go up over Mooseburg.
When you say a flag, this is somewhere where there had been a swastika flying, but the new flag was?
American flag.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then all the shouting and everything was going on, you know. And it wasn't shortly after that that Patton, our troops came up to the gate, and then Patton came, followed in right away and rode up on his big white tank, you know. Not white tank, but he looked like God anyway.
White gloves and pearl pistols, I'm sure.
Mayhem, you know, tears, you know, kissing ground and everything, hugging and everything else. And said we're going home, everything we could think about. And it didn't take long, though.
Just imagining or seeing in your mind's eye that American flag going up and Patton's forces coming through the gate brings all those emotions back for you, doesn't it?
Yes.
Another thing I saw in your book is basically your POW mugshot that the Germans had. How did you come to obtain that?
We had men of confidence in the camp, okay? And they were the ones that told us that they went into the main office for the camp. And as anybody wants their record, and they blow, you know, a bullhorn they got off one of the soldiers. Anybody wants to get their record, go in and get it. Go in and get it. So I went in and got my record.
And when you look at that picture now, what comes to mind for you? The life that you've had all these years since then and everything you've been able to enjoy, what comes to mind when you look at that picture?
How the good Lord took care of me, brought me back home.
Was that one of those memorable moments for you too, getting back to America?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, once we got liberated from camp, it became a little bit hectic, too, because May the 7th, there was a Luftwaffe airfield there, right outside the camp, and they were bringing American planes in, and they were flying us back to Reims, France. So while we're waiting our turn, we got a lot of guys to take care of. They made duck boards there, got water out of the creeks and everything else, and took showers and everything else. And somehow they got some uniform supplies or some clothes, whatever could get on, you know. And then we waited out, and they had a truck out there with donuts and coffee and all that kind of stuff. When it came your time to fly, you just held your pants up like this and whatever shirt you had on, got on the plane and went to France, which was a short ride. You're not that far, you know. They took us to a place that was reserved for us POWs, Camp Lucky Strike, and they debriefed us on our conditions that we're going to feed you. We're going to feed you with very small portions, and we don't want you to drink this much water. You don't need to get so much. They weren't going to put buckets out there and let us drown ourselves, you know. So that was the story, but they really brought us back properly, I guess you could call it, you know.
Yeah.
So little at a time, you know.
So you had joined the service on November 2nd. 1943. You were shot down November 2nd, 1944. What happened on November 2nd, 1945?
Oh, discharge, yeah. I was discharged then.
Did you want to fatten yourself up a little bit before you saw Ann again so you were sure she'd recognize you?
I was a skinny rail. It didn't make any difference to me then, you know. And my mother's my stepmother was trying to feed me. She said, go ahead, eat. I said, I can't eat. I didn't understand how my stomach was, you know. So I just didn't eat, you know. He says, well, you're never going to get better. I said, leave me alone. Then the soldiers rebelling at people because they don't understand.
And you said before you left, you had asked Anne if her parents would let her marry you, and she said absolutely not. How long did you wait before you asked again?
I was discharged in November, and I gave her a ring for Christmas.
And this time the answer was absolutely yes?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. We waited 9 months, and then we got married in September of the next year.
And you've been married ever since, 67 years. What's your secret?
Liking one another. If you're madly in love, and it might, you know, but if you like one another and give each other a space, you don't have any problem, you know. Because I adored her, you know, sure I loved her, you know. And the fact that she did anything for me that I wanted, you know, but liking one another and being compatible, I think. She went on bowling parties with her, go. You know, I went golf trips, I go. There was no, you're going out again, you're going, you know, none of that.
Right.
None of that ever existed. We both gave ourselves space, and then we had our space together.
Well, that's good advice for the rest of us. I know that you've experienced plenty more, and you've been involved in the American Ex-Prisoners of War and the national leadership. You were at the National World War II Memorial when it was dedicated in 2004. You've seen and done a lot in your 90 years. When you look back on everything you've been through, what are you most thankful for, or what are you most proud of?
Well, first of all, I owe everything up to my dear wife, you know, and together with the three children we had. I just am so thankful that I had that freedom and not worry that I could make decisions without making problems for everybody and myself. You know, I says, if I put your pillow, head down on a pillow and I go to sleep, forget everything, just, you know, petty things. And you have to screen to take you know, oh, I got this, owe this money. That's not important, or so many other things is important than petty things. I call them petty things, you know. And I think my children learned from me, not that I was firm about it, you know, but I think by example I learned. There's only so much you need anyway, you know. Oh, you'll get that later. Don't worry about it. It's not, you know, this. And the less you demand, the easier it is.
And that perspective, I'm guessing, came from your time as a prisoner of war, that you realized how little you really needed?
Yeah, I think so. There's things that you're going to experience in your life that are very traumatic, but there are more things that are happy. So you don't dwell on the sadness and everything else. There's solutions to all things like that, sadness, you know, and some good might even come out of them, you know. Yeah. But don't dwell on it because you'll ruin yourself.
I know you believe that God had a plan for you, and speaking of, I forgot to ask you about one other thing you did in the prison camp that I know you've reenacted for your kids. Tell us what your POW ingenuity led you to craft out of a few pieces of string.
Being a Catholic and raised a Catholic in grade school and everything else, you know, and we learned to pray the rosary, and naturally we had our prayer books and rosaries, military rosaries with us, and when the Germans took them off of us, I was no secret. The other people did it too, so I followed suit and made a rosary and used them to sustain my faith. And my prayers were to make me healthy and return to my family, and I dedicated myself to that. You know, I told the dear Lord, if you let me get out of this predicament that I'm in, I'll never complain in my life. And I've done that.
Well, and you're proving it right now, because we're doing this interview in the VA hospital where they're treating you for a broken arm, and I haven't heard you complaining. Frank, I want to just thank you for serving our country. Thank you for writing your story, and I hope a lot of people will pick up your book, 11-2, and read about it. And I guess we should wrap up with the final 11-2, because we talked about November 2nd, 43, 44, and 45, but there's another more recent November 2nd that's important. Tell me what that is.
Writing the book. I says, I think I should write something about my family, maybe 10 pages of my experiences, you know. My daughter Cheryl says, Dad, what are you doing? I said, I'm writing my memoirs. She says, what are you doing that for? Her and her sister was already talking about it. She says, that's not good enough. We're going to tell your story in the service, when you were in the service, too, not just about the family. I want everybody to know what you did. So with their encouragement, They met at my house every Monday night for over 2 years, and I had my drawers filled with everything that I had, paperwork and notes and letters from my friends that helped me, and I researched a lot of the places I was, and I researched this, and then they started putting in order and everything else and pumped me real good for questions, you know. So it all came out, and I think they did a good job. You know, if anybody hears part of the story, they'll realize what I'm trying to say. And if it helps one person to straighten their life out and lean towards the good Lord or something, or not worry about something, then it's possible.
Well, I know your story has touched a whole lot more than just one person today. And hopefully, if you enjoyed hearing from Frank, you'll look into his book, published on November 2nd, 2010. 11-2, One World War II Airman's Story of Capture, Survival, and Freedom. I have it linked on that Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're out of time for now. Thanks for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again, as Frank Kravitz did so powerfully today, that freedom is not free.